Hi, I'm Lisa Colton, and you're listening to Drinking and Droshing, Torah with a Twist. And for real, let all who are hungry come and eat.
Hey, Gabe.
Hey, Amanda.
I've been thinking.
Okay.
So, you know how we live in a Brooklyn apartment?
Yes, we do.
Okay. So in our Brooklyn apartment, I have found that our smoke detectors go off a little too easily.
I don't disagree with you there. It's not always pleasant.
And I've been thinking a lot about this week's portion and last week's portion. And I gotta tell you, I'm not so sure that we could sacrifice so easily in our apartment with the smoke detectors.
To be fair, they also did their sacrifices outside, but I understand your point.
Do you think that that's what the sacrifices were about? Like, people were invited for a barbecue?
I mean, the priests did eat, you know, some of the meat, but I think it was more about, you know, worshiping God and getting closer with God and, you know, the ritual of it all.
So this might have been kind of a prototype of the Jewish conference where everybody gets to bring an offering and maybe enjoy some buffet.
Huh. Well, that's one way to put it.
I think that there's a guest who might be able to help me out understand this just a little bit more.
Sounds like fun to me.
All right, let's get started.
Let's go.
So last week was kind of a big deal because we started a brand new book, the book of Leviticus, with, you know, the first portion that is Vayikra, which is also the Hebrew name for the book of Leviticus, which could be a little confusing when you have the title, like chapter, the title Parsha, matching the title of the book. But don't worry, we've made it to the second portion of the book, which is equally important, kind of, except maybe not really, because it's more commandments and it's a little confusing. But really impressively and importantly and significantly to all of our listeners, it was, in fact, co-host Gabe Snyder's bar mitzvah portion, which is going to be the thing that goes down in fame for me for the rest of my life about Parshat Tzav. However, when we were looking at Parshat Tzav and kind of the qualities and interesting tidbits that it had to talk about, we saw things that were really important to us as people who love doing some of these things, like cleaning, me, not Gabe, cooking, both me and Gabe, influencing, probably Gabe more than me as Rosh Morale, but we try, and ordination, which weirdly for me is coming up soon. For Gabe, he's got a little bit more than a year, but we're going to get there. It's going to be great. And all of this ties together in one portion, which seems weird. So how could we possibly find a guest that would be able to encompass all of these things of creating a holy space, welcoming people to it, and offering up something so beautiful that people could participate in? Well, we did. And so we're really excited to welcome Lisa Colton to our show, coming to us from Seattle, Washington. Lisa Colton is the founder and president of Darim Online, which is a nonprofit providing strategic consulting, facilitation, and design to Jewish organizations, helping them to navigate the exciting and sometimes scary changes happening in our society. Lisa is also the founder and co-executive producer of the Great Big Jewish Food Fest and the Big Bold Jewish Climate Fest, international online festivals that took place during the pandemic. Lisa is an avid home cook and passionate food enthusiast and annually makes a unique cocktail to welcome her guests to the Seder table. So Lisa, we know where we're going next time we're in Washington. We are so delighted to welcome you to Drinking and Droshing, Torah with a Twist. Welcome to the show, and L'chaim and B'tei Avon, like, enjoy your food. Yikes, we're so happy you're here.
Thanks, I'm delighted to be here.
We're delighted to have you here. Gabe, as someone who also loves cooking, maybe not the cleaning, but definitely loves the cooking and the drink making, I know how excited you're going to be for this particular guest. So how's it going? What's your enthusiasm level for Parshat Tzav, Bar Mitzvah Boy?
Today I am a man. That's a joke about bar mitzvahs. I'm so excited. And also, if my mother listens to this episode, she's going to be very upset because she always says that cleaning is a part of cooking. So I'm going to need to work on that. Sorry, Mom.
It's okay. I always say that patience is a virtue, just not one of mine. So, you know, hey, it's like a similar idea. Idan, who is possibly the best dish cleaner that I've ever gotten to work with. And also, like, I enjoyed cooking dinner with because I got to make some breakfast and dinners with Idan when we were in Haifa, like, years ago. How's it going, executive producer? What's going on? Welcome back. We missed you last week. We're thrilled you're here today.
I'm thrilled to be back. It's so good to see everybody's faces.
It's so good to see your face. And for those that don't know, we're just going to share. By the time you listen to this, it's already going to happen. But we're really excited because tomorrow we actually do get to share a meal with Idan, and it's going to be awesome. But for right now, we have so much to talk about and so much to get through. So let's get started on this incredible Parshat Tzav. I mean, we're commanded to, right? Baruchu Adonai Hamvorach.
Hi, what's going on? Are we in a Torah service?
Well, aren't we? I mean, I thought you said that this was your bar mitzvah portion.
Oh, it is. I'm so excited to talk about it.
Why? What happens in Parshat Tzav?
Well, we start with several offerings. There's the burnt offering. It's burnt. Second, the meal offering. Some of it is burned, but the rest is eaten by Aaron and sons as unleavened cakes. Next, there's the anointing sacrifice. It's like a more specific meal offering that Aaron and sons perform on the occasion of anointing a priest or king. Next, the sin offering, slaughtered before the altar like the burnt offering, but the priest eats some of this one. Up next, the guilt offering, slaughtered where the burnt and sin offerings are both slaughtered. The blood gets dashed on the altar, and some specific parts and all the fat get burned, and the men of Aaron's family get to eat the rest. Also, the priest who performs the sacrifice keeps the skin for some reason. Last one for now, well-being. If it's for Thanksgiving, then cakes of various kinds are offered with the sacrifice. The priest dashes the blood and the flesh gets eaten, but it has to be eaten that day, no leftovers. If it's a free will offering, you can have leftovers, but only the day after. The rest gets burned on the third day. If it gets eaten on the third day, then the offering doesn't count and the person who eats it bears the guilt. Some laws on purity and sacrifices come next. The flesh can't touch anything impure, and only pure people can eat the flesh. Not a person in a state of impurity or who touched something impure like an impure animal. Some meat laws. Don't eat the fat of ox, sheep, or goats. Also, don't eat animals that were killed by beasts, but you can use the fat for other purposes. Also, don't eat blood. So then we learn about the ordination of the priests. Moses takes Aaron and sons, and then the clothes, and the anointing oil, and the bowl of the sin offering, and two rams, and the basket of unleavened bread, and assembles the community leadership at the entrance, and puts the clothes on the people, and the oil on all the stuff and all the people. Aaron and the sons touch the head of the bowl of the sin offering and slaughter it. Moses takes the blood and puts it on the altar. Moses then performs the guilt offering, but the remainder that would normally go to the priests is burned outside of the camp instead. Then there's the ram of the burnt offering. Aaron and his sons touch its head and slaughter it, and Moses performs the burnt offering. Then there's the second ram, the ram of ordination. Aaron and his sons, you guessed it, lay their hands on its head and slaughter it. Moses takes some of the blood and puts it on Aaron's right ear, Aaron's right thumb, and Aaron's big toe, and then same with each of the sons, dashing the rest of the blood on the sides of the altar. He then takes the fat and the kidneys and the piece of the liver and the right thigh and places them on the palms of Aaron and his sons along with the unleavened bread and oil and a wafer, and then burns all of it on the altar with the burnt offering. Moses then takes some of the blood and anointing oil from the altar and sprinkles it on Aaron and his sons and their clothes, consecrating them. Aaron and his sons are instructed to boil the remaining flesh and eat it with the remaining bread, and any leftovers are to be consumed in fire. They must stay in the tent of meeting for 7 days in order to complete their ordination. And that's Parashat Tzav.
I'm hungry.
You know, I don't think that the first time I read this portion, it really whet my appetite. I don't think that that was really where my head was. But yeah, I can see it. You know, the whole purpose of the burning is, you know, the smoke is apparently a pleasing odor to God. So I don't know, maybe this all smells like a good barbecue.
One might imagine.
Or like a really burnt barbecue, like one of the two.
Some people like their s'mores really burnt.
Hmm. All right. Well, next time I'm sacrificing some marshmallows, I'll call you.
Leah, Lisa, one of the reasons that I was really excited to have this conversation with you today was not only because you have done things with food and things with cocktails and been creative, but for two reasons that I think are really important. One is that you've talked about helping guide Jewish organizations through, you know, I would say celebrations and challenges. But the other is one of your Eli talks, you know, as one of the first Eli talks, a talk, you know, to the Jewish community about Jewish successes or new Jewish trends or new Jewish ways of doing things, talked about innovation, revolution, and tradition, which seems to be what you're doing with Dream Online. And so I was hoping you might be able to share with us what inspires you to do the work that you're doing with Dream Online, and what exactly are you doing with Dream Online?
That's a great question. And I actually don't even think my family could answer that succinctly. But basically, I've created a career for myself where I can do whatever I want with whomever I want. And that's a real blessing. Mostly, I mean, the start of it really was that I grew up in a very technologically literate family. I grew up in Seattle. I went to school in the Silicon Valley as the internet was like being birthed, which was a crazy experience in and of itself. And then when I really turned my attention to the Jewish community, I realized that we weren't yet harnessing the potential and the power of the internet to reach people and connect people. And that was kind of the genesis of the whole thing, looking at what are the opportunities in our world and our landscape right now, and how can we align what the Jewish community does and what our goals are, using those tools and opportunities to our advantage. And what that looks like really changes like every 18 to 24 months, which means I'm constantly innovating and able to take new ideas and kind of sculpt them and massage them and find collaborators to road test them, and then amplify those really fun and successful stories so others can take advantage of it too.
I love that there's this kind of variation to your work that, as you said, you can kind of do what you want with whomever you want. And also that you have a lot of different passions. Like, you're very much in the tech sector, you're in that world, but also you love cooking, and that's awesome. I'm wondering if there's a through line for you, if there's a value, if there's a belief, an insight that kind of drives you and connects all of these ideas, you know, connects all of these things that you're doing that are really amazing individually, but, you know, coming together in one person, all the more so.
Yeah, I think if I were to really just pick one value, it would be agility, which I think is really essential in our world right now that is rapidly changing. Like, the pace of change right now in our lifetimes is like exponentially greater than, I don't even know how far back I'd go, but in a really, really, really long time. So being nimble and agile, recognizing what's changing and kind of constantly rebalancing and adapting and adjusting is such a critical posture for anyone to have, but especially organizations and companies when the rules of the game are kind of constantly changing. And I think that's actually a very Jewish value too, but it's in tension with a lot of what we're taught to be kind of preservationist. And so a lot of my work is kind of holding those two values at the same time and helping people figure out where to kind of stick with the preservationist identity and where to actually embrace that more agile posture and what that looks like and what it feels like and how to get other people on board to be more agile. And interestingly, the pandemic, for as horrible as it was, forced a lot of people, a lot of leaders, a lot of community builders to be agile. Even if it was really uncomfortable and scary, it exercised new muscles. And I'm curious to see how that will play out in years and decades to come.
So I really love this idea of, you know, the ability of things being both preserved, but also reframed, reformed, you know, just maybe even transformed. And one of the things that you just reminded me of does come from this portion, and it's a fun line in the portion that is the reason that I think we have the eternal light in our synagogues. This idea of, for those following along at home, we're in Leviticus 6:6, but Ish Tamid Tukad Al HaMizbeach Lo Tikveh. So this idea of you should have a fire that is eternal, right? Esh Tamid, a fire that's going to always be kept burning on this altar. It's never supposed to be extinguished, right? Lo tik beh, never extinguished, always going. And there are two ways of thinking about that. Some believed it was a fire that just, like, you know, burned forever and you never need to do anything about it. And others believed, like you kind of talked about, is that it was perpetual, meaning that people kept lighting it, that they kept changing it out, that it kept having to have a hand in it. And so when we're trying to figure out these systems or these new things that get us excited or keep us kind of igniting those sparks, how do we get our hands around hopefully getting some continual energy? Or how do we know when to look outward to, you know, help us increase our sparks?
Wow, that's a great question. I'm going to switch the analogy from fire to water. And I often encourage people to think about kind of the power and energy and momentum of water. And if what you're doing feels like you're constantly swimming upstream, question whether it's the right approach. And if what you're doing feels like you're surfing a wave, that it's fun and creative and energized, then you're probably doing something right. And so I think the process of being agile is, first of all, paying attention to that energy flow and trying to optimize it. And if you feel like you're swimming upstream, it's probably because you're using old techniques with a new audience or in a changed environment. And it wouldn't work to use ice skates on gravel, for example. You got to use the right tool in the right place for the right purpose. And oftentimes we are pursuing the same goal, but doing it in a very inefficient way. And so letting go of some of those assumptions about how something should be done, letting go of that preservationist mindset about the how, while still holding on to the why. So preserve the why, but question the how. And with more kind of user-centric, empathetic, design thinking-esque processes, you can often find a totally new and sometimes surprising path. So, for example, in the early days of the pandemic, I had a lot of friends in the food businesses, and they were all completely shut down and terrified, and there was all this amazing talent that was around while everybody else was sitting at home scared and cooking more for themselves than they ever had before. And I was just seeing, oh, here's all these ingredients, pun intended, in the Jewish food world that can't be used in the way that they typically have. So, like, what if we just, like, remixed all of these ingredients? And because I spent a lot of my life thinking about and using technology, my business is called Darim, which is a made-up word inspired by the Hebrew word to dwell. So, like, dwelling online and using technology, right? I named this 20 years ago. But that's the essence of what I'm trying to help people do often. And I had this crazy idea of having an online Jewish food festival where nobody could taste or smell anything. I mean, it was a ridiculous idea at the moment, but all of the ingredients kind of fit together and the Venn diagram just was perfect. Like, there was this little spot in the middle that I could just see it all coming together. But it was a very unique moment in time. So I was designing with the ingredients and the opportunities and the psychology and the technology that just happened to be the intersection at that particular moment in time. And I think that's an example of agile thinking more than anything else, to see where that opportunity is. And then it's a different skill set to go and produce it and make it happen. But oftentimes we're not finding that sweet spot of the intersection. And so you feel like you're swimming upstream. But that sweet spot, you feel like you're surfing a wave.
I love that you brought people together over food online. I think that that's, like, just a phenomenal thing. Funny and unexpected and ironic and also fantastic. You know, it occurs to me, talking about all these sacrifices today, like, that's something we don't do anymore. That's something we haven't done for a very long time. And so, you know, it can feel pretty distant. It can feel very foreign to us to think about these sacrifices and these rituals. One of the things that I think is helpful for me is to think of the Hebrew for the sacrifices. They're called korbanot, which comes from this word karov, meaning like to bring closer. When we make sacrifices, when we made sacrifices way back in the day, it was all in an effort to bring us closer to God. And so I love that, you know, whether it's burning food or talking about it, I love that we are coming together over food. I'm curious, just, you know, as a, you know, personal thing, do you have any rituals or foods or meals that you, you know, particularly love to enjoy with guests? I'm thinking particularly Passover is right around the corner next week. Are you a Seder person? Are you a fan?
I'm a huge fan of Seder. I try and reinvent it every year to keep it fresh. Also, as my kids get older, right, like I'm designing for them. And it's been fun to make it a little more sophisticated and the questions changing every year. I actually use Haggadot.com and I make a new Haggadah every year that has some theme to it, either that's happening in the world or in our society, a whole range of freedom-oriented things that have been happening in the past decade or so to choose from. There was one Prince-themed Haggadah the year that he passed away, and it had a bright purple cover, and there was a purple cocktail to go with it, just for the record. I do love cooking, and I love cooking with people, and I love that you just like brought those words, the korban and the karov, together. Like, I don't know why I'd never put that together in my mind, but I think it's really true. My mom, when I was growing up, was a very ambitious professional, worked long hours. And one of the really special things that we did together was cooking. And she would take the day off before Passover and we'd cook together. She would take the day off before Rosh Hashanah and we would cook together. And so food to me, in the planning and the preparation, as well as the eating, is really about bringing people together and sharing of traditions and the stories you tell while you're cooking and the collaboration that happens in the process of cooking. So that really, really resonates with me. And I try to find opportunities to make the cooking part of hosting collaborative and part of the process, not just the kind of serving on a silver platter and entertaining part of it. Because the whole point is to bring us closer. It's not performance art. And that's why I love being like an avid home cook rather than a professional chef, because ultimately it really is about, you know, the relationships and the intimacy.
So I think not just the relationships and the intimacy, which I love, but also I would say when you're doing things like this, even in our portion itself, we talk about responsibility, right? I know we host a decent amount and all of our friends have different dietary needs. It's crazy. We love it, but it's, you know, we have people who are gluten-free, people who are dairy-free, people who are vegetarian, people who, like, you know, will only eat meat, people who can't have nuts, people who can have nuts but can't have tree nuts, you know? And so, like, we've gotten to a good place of knowing what everyone can eat. And you know, the joke that I always say to Gabe is, well, you can parve anything. Parve meaning you can make anything non-dairy if you try hard enough. But part of that is taking responsibility with and for the people who are coming to your table. And so for you, when you're helping lead these communities, whether they're coming into your home and helping cook, whether they're 20,000 people coming to your, you know, festivals, how do you balance that welcoming feeling, that hospitality feeling, that home feeling, with also like the reality of that responsibility that you have for these guests and these counterparts, and even I would say your collaborators?
That is a great question. And I want to give credit to Jeffrey Yoskowitz, who's one of the co-founders of the Gefilteria, in teaching me to really understand the concept, or just begin to understand the concept of hospitality. because in the Jewish world, we talk about being warm and welcoming all the time, but it's not about having somebody at the door who says Shabbat Shalom and hands you a siddur as you walk in. You can still feel completely disconnected from the people around you and like you're a stranger in the space, even if somebody said welcome at the door. And it's kind of a life posture about how you understand people's needs, whether it's avoiding tree nuts or that they're a little bit shy around new people or they prefer to be at a table with five other people than with 25 other people. Knowing who your guests are and designing intentionally for them to feel the most at home and the most themselves and that they can fully participate in whatever is happening is a beautiful value, and it's a real skill and an art. But even before it's a skill and an art, you just need to recognize how it happens. And that posture, having that sense of hospitality, is true whether you're having a few people over for dinner at your house or even your own family, or whether you've got 20,000 people online. And the way that we try to really set a culture of we all belong here. There's no threshold of Jewish knowledge or food knowledge or food snobbiness or whatever. There's zero threshold. You all belong. Everyone has something to contribute. The ways that people can contribute by sharing on Facebook or in comments of things or whatever. And we had that kind of ethos and personality and culture infuse everything that we did in the Food Fest, from the marketing to the daily emails that went out to how we introduced our guests and talent on the live sessions, to the fact that we made it philanthropic and that everybody could actually contribute to healing in those early days of the pandemic. And we picked a handful of organizations, some Jewish and some not, that represented the values that we wanted to embody throughout the festival. And we invited to people contribute like to the best of their means and ability. Some people gave $5 and some people gave $5,000. And collectively, we raised, I think, $150,000 for these organizations, including the Jewish Food Society, who was working with Feeding the Frontlines in New York and basically bought out some of the Jewish delis to keep them in business. So the owners had something to do, the staff stayed employed, the distributors and all the people who provided the products also could stay employed. And they made just a gazillion lunches that were then delivered to hospitals to help the folks on the front lines who were doing the really scary hard work be fed and nourished, right? And so if you think about hospitality as this kind of culture and nourishment as something that's more than just like the calories and the vitamins, it changes the way that you think about food and entertaining and gathering people. And it can infuse everything from, you know, your vodka to your desserts to the hug that you give as people walk out the door.
It brings a whole new meaning to this concept that we say at the Seder, let all who are hungry come and eat. You know, I love that phrase, that it's not just about the calories, that, you know, it's about the welcoming and the warmth and the community that you build. I'm curious, what is it about food? Like, it's just such a specific thing, but I can't think of a better way to bond with people than, you know, breaking bread, as it were. What is it about that piece of our culture and our like basic human animal needs that like is just so connecting that helps people come together?
I don't know. Somebody should like do a PhD on just answering that question. I mean, in my opinion, I think food and food traditions carry so much culture and history with them. So, you know, a lot of our Jewish food traditions, we like quote our grandmother or it came from Eastern Europe or this is something from Morocco, right? It's like it tells this very long, meaningful story in this one recipe. I also think just like animalistically that, you know, so many animals compete for resources, that there's like a scarcity mindset out in the world of like survival, right? And there's something about bringing people together around food that is just the opposite. It's generous. It's sharing. And it's abundant, regardless of what's actually on the table. If you have something and you're sharing it with other people around your table, you're basically saying there's more than I need to survive. There's an abundance here, and it brings people together. And I think that that's something that's, I don't know, fairly unique among humans. And it does bring us closer. Like if you have abundance, who are the people that you're going to share it with? And those are the people around your table. What do you think?
So I'll actually speak that I think that that is really lovely and speaks to this week's portion. And I was thinking about what you were saying before Gabe asked his question, just about the healing properties of not only food, but having people come together to be creative and to collaborate and to, you know, enjoy the culinary arts if they can. And I do also want to point out, like, I know that you also did a huge conference on climate change, and we're focusing so much, you know, on the food and the drinks because, like, that's where our hearts go to. But we also want to recognize that the climate change is also really important, and, like, you know, maybe doing smoke sacrifices probably wasn't so good for the environment all the time. But I did want to say, I think it's really meaningful that the two sacrifices in this portion that are called Kodesh Kodoshim, like that are the holiest of the holies, are the guilt offering and the sin offering. And I was thinking about this of when I feel really bad about myself, when I'm like down and just like, I can't believe I did that. I can't believe I should have done this. I could have done better. I feel ashamed. I feel guilty. I did something wrong. It's other people that tend to help me get out of that space, you know, and there's usually something that needs to happen when I feel stuck that other people need to help me get out of the space. And so I think what you said beautifully about this healing quality of these kind of ritual, either seders or dinners or even a cup of coffee or even giving someone a hug, can be incredibly powerful, especially when the world outside is scary. And I imagine at this point in our, you know, Torah, the world outside was very, very scary. When you went to bed at night, you didn't know if you were going to be up in the morning. And so you have taken it upon yourself to really guide people and you know, be not only an inspirer of organizations and people who come together and be creative and collaborate, but also to kind of just accompany people through what it seems like can be some challenging, scary times where we're not sure if we should be creative or stick to the status quo. And I loved your statement before, right, of preserve the why but question the how. How do you know when to reach out and you know, try something new? And how do you know when, like, it's safer to stick to the status quo? And what do you do when you might need to make a sacrifice in either direction?
Yeah, I think risk is scary. Like, hard stop. Whatever kind of risk it is, it's scary to do something new or where the impact of it is unknown. But we're also living in a time where not changing is risky. And so when you're thinking about something that's scary, you got to hold both sides of that equation. What's the risk of this change? But also, what's the risk of not changing? So for example, we don't do these sacrifices anymore because the temple, capital T, doesn't exist anymore. And if our ancestors were so paranoid about change at all, it might have been game over, right? We can't do the things that are in the Torah anymore because the temple no longer exists, so we're done. But no, they saw that there were other ways to do the why, even if the how was different. And we now have rabbinic Judaism and prayer and synagogues instead of a temple and sacrifices and priests. So actually, you know, while we're so preservationist in many ways, we're also incredibly innovative and agile. Now, I'm sure it wasn't one person who had one idea and like it was simple and easy. I'm sure it was a terrifying time. And there was a lot of disagreement about what Judaism would look like post-Temple. But here we are. So hopefully we don't have to reinvent and be agile in the sense of like that scale of change. I encourage people to just take small risks, prototype things, like try it in a small way that doesn't feel like you have to invest so much time or energy and money. So that if the investment is relatively small, the potential loss is small too, right? That's an easier risk to take. And you don't have to throw the baby out with the bathwater too, right? Like a lot about risk or change is actually about loss and grieving. And if you acknowledge that side of the equation, it often makes it easier to kind of evolve and change over time. If you've prototyped and tried something and gotten positive feedback, and then you acknowledge the loss that needs to come with giving up an old way of doing something. But what I know to be true is stubbornly staying the same doesn't necessarily bring us to a healthier or more nourished or more sustainable place. So we have to at least be comfortable with asking the questions and having some level of risk tolerance to play and be a little bit agile and be able to evolve.
I have a feeling you've kind of already answered this question, because this agility has been a through line of this entire conversation, even as we've, you know, bounced around agilely to different ideas and topics. But if you had, you know, one message, one call to action, one thing you wanted to share with listeners before they, you know, go on with the rest of their day, what do you want people to remember? What do you want people to get out of this conversation?
I think it would be to check yourself about your preservationist instincts. So the next time you feel resistant or a little like stuck in the mud about something, ask yourself why you're having that preservationist instinct. Whether you're like parenting teenagers or you're on your synagogue board, I think this applies all over the place. And ask if it's really serving your why. And if you were to try and preserve the meaning or the purpose or the intention, but maybe approach it in a different way, how could you think about designing for that why or purpose or intention in a different way? How might it look or feel different? It's not even the step of doing something different. I'm encouraging you just to question that instinct and see if you might be able to come at it from a different angle.
Hey, Gabe.
Hey, Amanda.
I've been thinking about the fact that your graduation is coming up soon. Like, you're going to get a Master's of Arts in Sacred Music, right?
Master's of Sacred Music, yeah.
Okay, so Master's of Sacred Music. And I was thinking, you know, look, like, I know we're not quite there, but this episode, you know, does talk about, like, kind of ceremonies. And I was thinking, what if we focused on your graduation for this week's drink? Like, what if we did it, like, the graduate's goblet, you know? Like, what if we did something, like, fun like that?
I mean, I would be honored, but, you know, A, I think that, you know, this Torah portion is a little less about graduation and a little bit more about, you know, offerings and, you know, particularly ordination offerings. You know, that's a pretty good name for a drink. The ordination offering. So why does God want us to burn stuff? Because the smoke rises up to heaven and apparently smells nice. I have trouble believing that the smell would be particularly pleasant, but to each their own. But in honor of the smoke and blood of the altar, we're going to make this very fun drink, the ordination offering. Start off with 1.5 ounces of mezcal for that smoky flavor. That goes into a shaker with 1 ounce of lime and 1/2 ounce of simple syrup for the vegetarian offerings. I couldn't figure out how to get flour into this drink. Maybe have a cookie on the side. For a non-alcoholic alternative offering, switch out the mezcal with 1 ounce of coconut water, 1/2 ounce of lemon juice, and just a drop of the ever difficult to pronounce Worcestershire sauce. Anyway, shake that with ice until well chilled and strain into a cocktail glass. The priests dash blood over the altar, but that sounds kind of messy, so over the back of a spoon, very carefully, float over top a half ounce of port or a dark red wine. For a non-alcoholic version, I recommend pomegranate syrup, though that will likely sink to the bottom. Praise God, try not to get any blood on yourself, touch a goat's head, l'chaim.
Love me some mezcal.
L'chaim.
Well, I'm a little anxious for ordination, and I'm not sure that I can make that offering without making a mess. I am really, both excited, sad, thoughtful, and just, questioning the fact that we've already made it to our penultimate section, our thank yous and closing cues. And so Lisa, Gabe, Idan, Sav gets into the nitty-gritty of the importance of creating a clean starting space. You know, we shovel those ashes, we get rid of them before crafting our special sacrifices. So how would you prep your space in order to do your best and most holy work? Lisa, we'll start with you.
Well, I'm working at kind of a symbolic cleaning process, which is letting go about caring about what other people think I should or should not be doing. That instead of trying to please others, that preparing for that holy work is really about cleaning my internal space, letting go of all of those assumptions, and just being my best self. Although I will say, paradoxically, sometimes having very clear instructions and structure for things can be a useful part of cleaning too, because it helps us not get caught up in the messiness of so many things that can go on in our mind.
I really appreciate that. As somebody who sometimes gets a little stuck in what people think of her, I'm going to try to hold that as a kind of spiritual cleaning. Gabe, my friend who loves cleaning so much, even if it's not cleaning, how do you prep your space to do your most and best holy work?
All right, so I'm going to go with the cooking theme here for a minute because I feel like we're on a roll with it. I'm going to go with the concept of mise en place, that you want everything to be in its place. You want to have everything prepared before you start cooking, because once things hit the pan, you got to be moving fast. You can't throw something in a pan and then go chop an onion. You want to have everything ready to go from the start. So that's my recommendation, is not only to start with a clean workspace, but to start with, all your ingredients out, ready to go, have a plan, really think through what you're doing. Do as I say, not as I do.
Maybe a friendly amendment to your mom's advice is the clean as you go philosophy.
Ah.
Because the mise en place is not only about preparing the ingredients, but also a reset between the prep and the cooking. And really, you've done two-thirds of the cleaning at that stage before you even cook.
Sound advice.
Gabe, as somebody who also is trying to get a little bit better about don't put things down, put them away, which is not always my best quality. I feel you in this, trying to make sure that everything has its place. And also, I do try to clean as I go when I cook. I don't always try to clean as I go, in my living space. But I'm going to work on it. It's always a way to improve. Idan, how do you kind of prep your space in order to do your best and most holy work?
Well, at first glance at my workspace, as someone who is as ADHD as I am, it might seem not that everything's just a big jumble, but really everything does have its place. That being said, I do tend to clean up in big flurries of cleaning. The real answer to this question is that it's all about your mindset. I find that if you're focused on other things, you can't really be working on the thing you need to be working on, whatever that is. You need to be fully focused on the thing you're doing, and splitting your focus is not going to help anybody. And so preparing yourself mentally to really jump in and just take care of business in that one area, that's what's really important.
Yeah, Gabe likes to tease me because once I read something and then read it that you can multitask, but you can't multifocus. So now when he wants us to focus on something, he'll just spit that back at me of, you know, can't multifocus, Amanda. My answer actually might not be popular, but I throw everything out. There comes a point sometimes where I just get tired of the mess and tired of things, and I want things to be clear, and I, you know, like my workspace to be clean and tidy, though it wouldn't necessarily look like it at the moment. The moment I have a dinosaur on my desk, true story, dinosaur on my desk, am I right? But I try to either throw things out or recycle or give them away or just get it out of the space, because in all reality, like half the time, the stuff that's on my desk, I don't need. For me, I think a lot of this, by the way, is the holy work that we do. You know, this podcast has been a really holy experience, and as part of my rabbinical school career, and I think Gabe's cantorial school career, and I think Edan's executive producing career, which, you know, might have just been us, but, you know, we love it. But we think that the work that we all do in this world tends to have a little bit of the sacred in it. And when we're able to, as Edan said, like be more mindful about kind of how we're setting up, that can be a really powerful place to begin. And I'm just going to throw out there, by the way, it's not just your physical space. It can also be your digital space. And that's an important thing too. So check out those desktops. Edan always laughs because PC users tend to save everything to their desktop and then have a messy desktop. And so I think about that a lot and try to organize it. But also, by the way, your environment, you know, what noise are you letting come in, or what TV shows are interrupting, what social media pings or buzzes are getting your attention, you know? And so being present and being there, maybe being able to just put things off, throw them away, get rid of it, and try to have a new space and a new thought pattern could be really helpful in coming to this new quality of doing. All of which, of course, are, you know, grounds for special conversations, because to each their own and everybody works differently. And so, Lisa, if people want to continue the conversation, how could they best find or follow you?
I'd love to continue the conversation. You can find me at darim.org, D-A-R-I-M, or lisacolton@gmail.com. Straight up and simple is my email. And I'm Lisa Colton on all the usual platforms, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, whatever. I'm not the professional viola player, Lisa Colton. I'm not the vascular disease specialist. And I'm not the Instacart shopper. But I think it'll be pretty obvious who I am on all those platforms.
Incredible. You know, we could have been down for an Instacart shopper, but like, you know, that's fine. Like, you do really good work on your own, right? Like, you know,
I was surprised to see her on LinkedIn, but I'm glad that she's proud of her gig work.
Incredible. So may we all be proud of our gig work. Lisa, any last words, thoughts, concerns, or jokes? I know Gabe is very excited for a potential joke that you have for this episode.
I'm ready to satisfy.
Go for it.
Brace yourself. What do you call the vestment the priest wears during the burnt offering?
What?
A blazer.
That's awesome.
Definitely a winning joke, both for this Parsha and for Gabe. Lisa, we are so grateful that you came to spend this time with us and to teach us and to collaborate with us in both, like, kind of what we might be preserving and how we might look to the future and see some changes coming through. What we might be able to let go of, you know, in terms of just trying to see how living our dreams might look like. And so we're very, very grateful for you for coming on. Gabe, incredible rundown, incredible drink today. I'm very anxious about its mess, but I believe in you. I won't make it because I would make a mess, but I'm excited to see you try. Edan, thank you as always for being here and helping out with technology and also making sure that we stay focused and on time and, you know, working on the holy work that we do. Thanks to Mike for doing the editing and making us sound brilliant. We're so appreciative. And thank you, of course, to all of our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you. And by the way, did we mention we've hit over 20,000 downloads? We're close to 21. It's very exciting. And so we may have a new announcement coming to you soon about something that we're really, really excited about coming your way. And so stay tuned for the conclusion coming now. you know, it might surprise some people, not all people, but some people, to know that one of the things that I wrestle with, and I think I've gotten better about it, but I still do wrestle with it at times, is rigidity. That sometimes I have an idea of how I think things should be, and if it's not that way, I get a little anxious, I get a little shaken. And one of the things that I really appreciated about Lisa's conversation with us is this ability of zirizoot, which I always thought of as alacrity, right? Zeal, like moving quickly to get something, but which she referred to as agility, the ability to kind of bounce around and back and not necessarily be so stuck in what you thought something was supposed to be.
It's interesting to put that kind of alacrity or that agility into conversation with the rituals that are described in Sav, with, you know, the tradition of food, these things that are kind of set, right? That, like, don't change, right? Like, that's not really how tradition works. The whole point is that we continue it on.
I think to a point, I think that it's a link in a chain, but I also think that one of the things that I appreciate, especially for me about being a Reformed Jew, is that there are what we call freedoms, positive freedom and negative freedoms. And I've talked about this a little bit before, but not for a while. So a positive freedom is something that we have to do something, right? We have the ability to make a choice that we're going to do a mitzvot, that we're going to, like, actually partake in a traditional vibe. And a negative freedom is we have the choice to not, right? We have the choice to not do sacrifices anymore. We have a choice to not keep kosher if that's not what, you know, jives for us. We have the ability to not keep Shabbat if that's what, you know, jives for us. But I find a lot of the time that in Reformed Judaism, we err or we lean toward the side of negative freedom. We choose not to do something versus choosing to do something. And I'm curious if, you know, we could really use Lisa's words of, you know, preserve the why, question the how, of how we might preserve some of these things a little differently, how we might live some of these Jewish values and, you know, enjoy the Jewish content just in a new, modern, transformative way.
My favorite thing to put up in a classroom, and I took it from a Haggadah, is you're free to ask, you're free to question, free to learn the answers of tradition, free to create answers of your own. And, you know, I think that that's just so applicable to this conversation about the rigidity of tradition. We need to ask and we need to question. We need to wrestle with our traditions. We need to interrogate them. And why are we doing this? And also, we need to learn about them. We need to learn the answers of those traditions. We need to preserve it on some level. And we need to add to that conversation. We need to add another link in the chain. And whether that means, you know, adding a little extra salt to your grandmother's matzo ball soup recipe, or it means saying, you know what, that ritual doesn't really appeal to me. It doesn't really do it for me anymore. Either way, that's part of tradition. Putting your own spin on it, putting your own mark on it, making your own choices. So we're so happy that you made the choice to spend this time with us. It's been such a fun episode. You can get in touch with us at drinkinganddroshing.com. And, you know, make sure to give us a rating on Apple Podcasts, share us with your friends, and we'll see you soon. L'chaim.
L'chaim.
Hi, I'm Lisa Colton, and you're listening to Drinking and Droshing, Torah with a Twist. And if you haven't yet befriended the smoky mezcal, you really should consider it.